Blog Talk Radio.
Spirit of Truth Ministry is delighted to bring you the Revelation of Jesus with Rick Sterling, where we test the beliefs of Christianity against the very words of Jesus that he gave his own eyewitness disciples. Join us for a unique and challenging study into truth, justice, and the kingdom of heaven. Hello and welcome, everyone. My name is Dennis Neufeld, and I am here with our Spirit of Truth Ministry research team getting ready for another dynamic discussion and I guess you'd call it a mini seminar, really. Into the truth that is titled The Revelation of Jesus with Rick Sterling. And apropos of that, sitting directly across from me, across our kitchen table, is the man himself, Rick Sterling. And along with Rick is Suzette, Dr. Don, and Larry. Glad to see all of you here today. We are delighted. It looks like we have Roger on with us this morning, and that's lovely. Good morning, and we are just about to get going, but before we do that, I want to have you go over to the chat room. If you are not already up, you can make comments and ask questions there. We also have our official website and original website email and mailing address written there, so you can use all of those facilities at your pleasure. Our official website is located at spirittruthministry.net. We would encourage you to go there and take a look at our book, The Spirit of the Church, by Rick Sterling and me, Dennis Neufeld. This book was published in 2007, and it has far outlasted the publishing company that actually published it, because they're no longer in business. By the way, I don't want you to get the impression that they went out of business because they published our book. That was a real fight. And incidentally, you can go to our original website, go to our new book page, and on the left-hand column, there is a description about what it took to get this book published. And it's kind of an interesting story, and we will not go into that here. Let's have prayer, and we will get started. Father in heaven, Jesus Christ, Holy Spirit, your names. Thank you for being here with us in spirit and in truth. Thank you for defending us against the evil ones who would seek to come in here and wherever we are heard around the world, whenever we are heard, to disrupt things, to cause confusion and uncertainty. I pray, Father, that you will, in your great mercy, send your Holy Spirit, our mother, to wherever we are being heard, to infuse those people who are listening with the power of great discernment. And I thank you for this in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen. Good morning, Suzette.
Morning.
Good morning, Dr. Don and Larry.
Good morning.
And good morning, Rick. It's nice to see you hale and hearty today.
Whatever that is, but...
That used to be a piano duo. Oh, no. That used to be a singing, a couple of singers...
I know Laurel and Hardy, but...
Hale and Wilder.
Actually, it's just a cliche.
We're starting early, are we, Larry?
So I'll start with a question, typically. Can you tell me when the judgment started? So the first part of the judgment began. When was that?
At the end of the 2300 days.
No, it's a little bit before that. God...
All right. I know. Matthew 21:43.
Genesis 2, I heard.
Okay.
Yes.
Got kicked out of the garden.
Genesis 2.
Oh, sure. Okay, that makes sense.
Now,
Genesis 3:15, all that stuff.
When we consider that, I mean, you can turn to Genesis 2 and 3, and if we take a close look at it, keeping in mind one very important point. Would God ever change the criteria and the principles in judgment from the first? So in other words, what occurred in this first judgment, would that be different from the final judgment?
Not to sound flip, but it better not be, because if it is, then people before the flood, people before, even going back to before the world was created, would be judged by a different standard, it would just be a whim of God.
Yeah. Whatever.
Whatever he says goes. He'll kill whoever he wants, and
whatever God determined people were going to be judged on at this particular time or that particular time or sometime down the line. And so what type of system does that sound like? In other words, does it sound like a stable common law system? Or does it sound like the whim of a dictator?
It is capricious.
Is it fair? Not at all. In fact, how would anyone know what they were being judged on? What was the specifics that would be brought in the judgment concerning their case? Let's look at this first judgment, which took place in the garden of the paradise of God, and why there was a judgment at all. First of all, when we understand that the purpose of the second creation.
Whoa. Second creation?
I can hear the grinding.
I've already talked about the first creation.
Yes,
I said
you
it
did.
Yesterday. So
you did.
The purpose of the second creation was so the first creation would that God would be able to judge the people of the first creation because they would have been informed of what the lawful standard was upon which they would be judged. In other words, they had been lied to, but they didn't know it was a lie. So they had been misled into a situation which put them against God. The second creation, the beings of the second creation, were to inform the beings of the first creation that they were being lied to. And then they would be able to choose between the watchers who had lied to them, or God who had created them.
I don't know if this fits here or not, but a thought just crossed my mind. Ever since the first creation and their deception, hasn't everybody been warned in advance of being lied to?
Well, I mean, that's where we're starting out.
So Adam and Eve were instructed and...
That's where we're going.
Yeah.
That's where we're going.
And I'm thinking ever since then, in general at least, everybody's been warned in advance that they could get lied to.
That's where we're going.
And then the question would be, why didn't the first creation get that privilege?
Well, they would have had things happen differently. When God created man, we find that in Genesis chapter 2, verse 6. However, a flood was rising from the earth and watering all the surface of the soil. Yahweh God fashioned man, and the Jerusalem Bible translating that word Yahweh God is in fact Elohim, E-L-O-H-E-E-M, or E-L-O-H-I-M. Then he breathed into his nostrils a breath of life, and thus man became a living being. So it's important to understand there are two parts here. In a spiritual being, as I understand it, there are two parts, but they operate differently. There is the spiritual body, and then the consciousness awareness. The consciousness awareness in the human is a result of the physiological processes taking place in the brain. So it is the mind. The mind is all that we have to concern ourselves with as far as salvation and doing what God wants us to do. Our body, which supports the mind. In other words, what I want you to understand is that the mind cannot operate apart from the body because it is the cellular processes in the brain that give us this consciousness awareness. So when God formed the body of the man of the dust of the ground, and he made everything ready for the man to wake up, it wasn't until he breathed the breath, which would be life-starting processes in the brain and in the body, so that the man would, as it were, wake up from asleep and look around and see Elohim. When the man would die, because he was mortal, because he was flesh and blood, the consciousness awareness would go away, but what was in the intellect, what was in his intellect, would not. It doesn't exist apart from the body, but it is preserved as if you would have fallen asleep. So when you go to sleep, you dream. When you die, which is like sleep, you don't dream. But the personality that you are is preserved for the resurrection when you are awakened. Yes. Like when you shut your computer off, you can't use it anymore because it doesn't operate. But when you turn it on and everything gets loaded back into the ROM, then you can use it. So a spiritual being is different because a spiritual being cannot die. It doesn't wear out. A spiritual being can only be judged and executed based upon the result of the judgment. And it can only be put to death by a fire that is not like a campfire. It is a fire of plasma like we see in the sun. As I understand it. So, what is it? Why was there a judgment in the garden of the paradise of God? And what was the reason for this judgment? Well, we will go on reading. And verse 8 of chapter 2, Genesis. Elohim planted a garden in Eden, which is in the east, and there he put the man he had fashioned. Elohim caused to spring up from the soil every kind of tree, enticing to look at and good to eat, with the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil in the middle of the garden. Goes on and it talks about the four rivers. And then verse 16. Then Elohim gave the man this admonition. What is an admonition?
A strong encouragement.
A command.
A command.
A command.
Yeah. A command.
So, verse 16, you may eat, indeed, of all the trees in the garden. Nevertheless, of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you are not to eat. For on the day you eat of it, you shall most surely die. And what he's saying there is, you will be put to death. On that day that you disobey, you will be put to death. No questions asked. Now, if you think about it, why would God do that? If God really wanted to restore the earth, he wanted to put down the rebellion, restore the earth back to the way it was when he created it, why would he do this? It would almost seem like for God, who really wants to accomplish this restoration, he's actually put a stumbling block in there. They'd say, well, you couldn't, I mean, that's, say there's 1,000 trees that bear fruit in the garden, and you can eat from any one of them. There's one tree that God said, don't you ever eat from that tree. And as the woman says later on, not even touch it. Don't think about it. Don't touch it. Don't eat from it. You are forbidden from that tree. That if they ate from that tree, or if they didn't eat from that tree, they wouldn't starve to death. They have all this other food. They have plenty of food. But this tree, they're not to eat from. So is God being dictatorial? Is he being overbearing? Is he being unrealistic? Is he not being fair? What is it? Well, we can't say that he's not being fair because he's given them more than they could eat from any of the other trees. all this tree really represents is, will you obey me? And it's not a hardship. It is not impossible for them not to eat from that tree.
It needs to be demonstrated that God can trust them and that he is, in fact, their God, and they won't listen to other gods.
That's right. And so now we go on. The woman is taken from the side of the man, fashioned and made from the rib to be his helper and his companion. Chapter 3. The serpent was the most subtle of all the wild beasts that Yahweh God had made. Now, we really need to understand, and I've explained this before, I'm going to explain it again, because it is important. This is not a snake. This is the serpent, the same one that's talked about in Revelation chapter 12. That ancient serpent, the devil and Satan. Well, ancient serpent, what would make it an ancient serpent?
It was around for a long time.
And the great red dragon is a serpentine beast. And you've also heard of the reptilians that the, you know, extraterrestrial people are talking about, the reptilians. This reptilian serpent was the wisest. He was a teacher, a watcher. His whole involvement in this is that he had led the whole first creation astray by lying to them. And he knew what God's plan was, and he knew that unless he was able to get these people to submit to him, to believe him and his lies, they would disqualify themselves for the purpose of which they were made. How would he get them to disqualify themselves? Get them to believe a lie. And not only just any lie, but get them to believe that God had lied to them and was trying to keep something from them that, if they knew about, would make them transcend from their flesh, blood, just black and white knowledge, and go into the divine knowledge. They would be like gods. They would know what the gods knew.
Well, their biggest error was in believing something and acting on it that was in direct opposition to the truth and instruction and commands of God, just like happened post-resurrection in the New Testament.
The difference between the man and the woman in the garden and the people, the nations of the first creation, were is that the first creation did not know what right and wrong was. God, who created them, had not said, I am your God. He had sent the teachers down, the watchers, who taught them and actually led them to believe what was not true. But they didn't know that. The man and the woman in the garden were to inform them of that. And God had specifically said, God himself, understand this, God himself, and it was probably Michael, the Son of God, who gave them this command.
What would be interesting, and I'm not aware that we have any information to say one way or the other, but certainly Lucifer must have been put to a trust and a obedience test before he was allowed to be a teacher and watcher. Would he not have been?
I don't know if he was put to the test before, but...
Or was that, in fact, his test?
Yes, that was his test. So, the serpent asked the woman, did Elohim really say you were not to eat from any tree in the garden? The woman answered the serpent, we may eat the fruit of the trees in the garden, but of the fruit of the tree in the middle of the garden, God said, you must not eat it, nor touch it, under pain of death. Now, the death that she was speaking of here is not the death of a mortal. Most Christians, or all Christians, all the ones that I know, tell me that the man and the woman in the garden, when they were created, were immortal. Well, that's not true, but they did have access to the tree of life so that they could eat from it and never die. The tree of life would be a moot point if they were immortal. They wouldn't need the tree of life. And God is not arbitrary. I mean, God doesn't do things just for the sake of doing them. So they were mortal. So the penalty for what they did is not becoming mortal. The penalty for what they did was to be put to death, not to eventually die, is what I'm trying to say. So the serpent said to the woman, no, you will not die on the day that you eat from the tree. Elohim knows, in fact, that on the day you eat it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like gods. And that's small g.
Yes, capitalized.
Yeah, it's small g. Knowing good and evil. Knowing good and evil. How would they know evil? What is evil? That is the question. How do we know what evil is? We haven't eaten from the forbidden tree. Do we know evil? What is evil? Well, evil is believing a lie and acting on it. Believing a lie, treating it as truth, and acting on it. What is evil? Evil is sin. Sin is wickedness. Wickedness is lawlessness. In other words, when one acts, if the law does not apply to them, believing that God is not going to hold them accountable for going against what he said not to do. Because the devil made them do it.
So it works both ways, doesn't it? Going against what he said not to do or going against what he said to do?
Well, yeah, it's kind of the two sides of the same coin. All right.
One other thing, too, Satan actually didn't lie when he said, asked that question to Eve. What would have happened had, see, Satan was provoking God here. Satan, I believe, was trying to get God to kill them. Because if he could do that, he could show the rest of the universe, the created beings in the universe, that God was capricious, just like we were talking about before. But God is a God of laws.
God does not lie. Ever.
Ever, right.
Now, what the devil said to the woman was, well, it was a lie with a qualification, is that the execution, which was to happen on the day of their disobedience, was stayed. So it wasn't commuted, it wasn't canceled, it was stayed. There was a stay of execution that was given to the man and the woman in the garden, but we haven't got there yet, so we'll continue to read. The woman saw that the tree was good to eat and pleasing to the eye, and this is the important part of the devil's deception. He doesn't tell you, he intrigues you, but he doesn't tell you the cost. And that it was desirable for a knowledge it would give. Now, there's an interesting thing here that I see. This tree is a regular tree. Now, certainly it had been set apart, so God had in fact made it holy, because he had set it apart and then forbidden them from eating from it. To eat from it would be to corrupt or to treat it as common, treat it as any other tree. Mm-hmm. And that the devil said you would learn not from it by eating from it. How is it that we gain knowledge and wisdom? Can we go to a fruit tree and eat from it and go, oh, I never understood that before?
That's not how it works.
Do we learn what we need to know? Do we gain knowledge by eating physical fruit? No. But this is while the devil works. He does not want us to understand that God teaches in spiritual language. We do not need to break the commandments to gain wisdom about anything. We do not need to break the commandments to become divine, to learn what we need to know to become what we hope to become. God had told them never to eat from that tree. If they ever did, they would be put to death on that day. That is wisdom. That is wisdom. If you don't want to be found guilty in the judgment and be put to death, then you listen to what God says and you do it.
Maybe we've come to the point where I can reinsert what I, or follow up on what I said earlier about being wicked or evil is not simply not doing what God said not to do, but also doing what he said to do. And an illustration of that is in Matthew 19. The commandment keeping alone isn't all sufficient. God added, he accepted the fact that this rich young ruler had kept the commandments. He didn't dispute that, but he gave him an instruction of something to do that he chose not to do, which cost him.
Cost him, yes. Cost him spiritually, although he probably went on and remained rich, although I don't know. We never hear about him again. But it cost him spiritually.
So Adam and Eve would have needed to have done more than simply obey the command of not eating from the tree. They would have needed to learn truth to a greater degree to be effective witnesses.
Did they know God?
Not well enough.
They knew of God, but they didn't know God.
Just a quickie here. A couple of nights ago, I was listening to a lecture on the leading figures of the Reformation. In this particular case, I believe it was Calvin, and how his concept was that you did not need to know God in particular, but simply to worship and obey. And I'm hearing that.
How can you worship and obey that which you don't know?
Yeah.
Based on our understanding, how does that jive at all with John 4 and the idea of you do not know
but
who
Calvin
you worship?
Got that from Paul. So here's the thing. The man and the woman were created by Elohim. And my understanding is that the Elohim would come into the garden in the cool of the day and talk with them. My argument is, if they really knew their Creator, if they really knew the Creator, they would never have disobeyed them. Why? Because they would love them. They would love them because they knew them. And they would never disobey, go against what someone they loved said not to do. That is why when the Son of God says, if you love me, keep my commandments.
And going even beyond love, in John 17, the concept of being one and united and of a same mind as God adds to that love, or is involved in as part of that love. So you work in harmony and consistency.
You cannot love someone you do not know. Well, I love everybody. I've had people tell me, I love everybody. That's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as a Christian, we're supposed to love everybody, right? We're supposed to love everybody. How can you love someone you don't know? Well, I love them. Now, what is your love? Your love is insincere. It's just a statement.
Mm-hmm.
Because love is a connection that grows from knowing.
Love also can be just a cliche.
So the woman saw the tree was good to eat, pleasing to the eye, and that it was desirable for knowledge that it could give. So she took some of its fruit and ate it. She gave some also to her husband who was with her, and he ate it. And then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they realized they were naked. So they sewed fig leaves together to make themselves loincloths. Now, I don't know if the fig leaves back there in the garden were this way, but I don't know if you've ever touched a fig leaf. It's a prickly, sticky, very uncomfortable. Yes.
Right.
Like a hair shirt?
Yeah, it's prickly.
You could have found something a little more comfortable.
The man and his wife heard the sound of Yahweh God. Remember, that's Elohim, and Elohim is God's plural, Father, Mother, and Son, walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and they hid from the Elohim among the trees of the garden. But the Elohim called to the man, "Where are you?" he asked. "I heard the sound of you in the garden," he replied. "I was afraid."
Okay.
"Because I was naked."
He was afraid because he was naked? Or he was afraid that he was going to be executed?
Yeah. "Who told you that you were naked?" he asked. "Have you been eating of the tree I forbade you to eat?" Well, and now we have the blame game.
Yep.
Then the man replied, "It was the woman that you put with me." Okay, so who is the man blaming for his crime?
God.
God. I wouldn't have done this if you hadn't given me that woman.
Yep.
He's not blaming the woman, per se. He's blaming God.
Yep. Seemed pretty thrilled with her back in Genesis 2.
Well, yeah, she was flesh of his flesh and bone of his bone. Now all of a sudden, it's the one you gave me. "She gave me the fruit, and I ate it." Okay.
Yeah.
So who did what God said not to do? Did he have to take the fruit?
No.
Did he have to eat the fruit? No.
He made a decision.
And if he was with her, why didn't he just say, we're not listening to this serpent here. We're not listening. He's like standing back going, you know, what's happening here? He's just kind of following along with what's going on. He's not saying a word.
You wonder if his operating system at that time was dopey-dopey-do.
Well, you know.
He didn't have
now,
on his
now the woman who has just been blamed for this whole thing said, "The serpent tempted me, and I ate." Then Yahweh God said to the serpent. Now, the serpent, I imagine, has one of those kinds of grins on his face that is described as having eaten something that is not edible. So what is God, what is Elohim doing? What is Elohim doing here?
Judging.
He's finding out the facts in the matter.
Right.
What is that?
Truth.
Judgment. That is a judgment process. Mm-hmm. Finding out the truth, the facts, and evidence.
Right.
Discovery,
yes. So, Elohim says to the serpent, "Because you have done this. What is that? It is a statement of judgment. Be accursed beyond all cattle, all wild beasts. You shall crawl in your belly and eat dust every day of your life. I will make you enemies of each other, you and the woman, your offspring and her offspring. It will crush your head and you will strike its heel. What is this it's? And what is this? I mean, this really doesn't make a lot of sense. If we understand it the way that it is written,
it's probably gender assignment by the editors and translators of and compilers of the Bible.
Yeah, but snakes were not accursed to slither around in the dust at this point in time. So, what is all this mean? I will make you enemies of each other, you and the woman. So the woman, Eve, will be made an enemy of the serpent. Is that, you know, if we look at Revelation 12, 17, or if we look at Revelation 12, what do we see? We see two main players there. The two main players are what? Red dragon and a woman. Where are they? Where are the red dragon and the woman? In the heavens. It says, I looked in the heavens and I saw a woman clothed with the sun standing on the moon, or the moon at her feet, and a great red dragon. So it's in the heavens. A woman and a serpent. Right? What, in fact, is Elohim saying here when he says, I will make you enemies of each other, you and the woman? Two kingdoms. You see, the man and the woman in the garden were the progenitors of the kingdom of God. That's what the whole thing was. He had set out a separate place, the garden. He had taken them from outside the garden and put them into the garden. So the garden is a territory that belongs to God in a world that has been taken over by the serpent. Okay? When the man and the woman did what the serpent told them to do and disobeyed God, what happened to them?
They were judged.
They were judged. They were found guilty. And they were kicked out. Now, is this typical of what God does? Well, let's think. Did God delineate a geographical area to be the land where his kingdom would live?
Yes.
It was called the Promised Land. Why was it called the Promised Land?
Because God promised Abraham.
God promised Abraham that's what it would be. So, and who were the people that he put in the Promised Land? the children of Israel.
A.K.A. Kingdom of Heaven.
And he said, if you, now, you're in the land, what did they need to do in order to stay in the promised land? Obey. Obey what? The covenant, the testimony. They had to obey the testimony. Well, they didn't. And when they reached the limit of forgiveness. Now, first of all, they never became holy. They were never holy when he brought them in, but he had to bring them in anyway because he had made a promise to Abraham. Otherwise, these people would be living in the wilderness. Hello? Living in the wilderness forever. So they reached the limit of forgiveness, and what happened to them? Kicked out. Mm-hmm. They were kicked out of the promised land.
You know, Larry just said Valley of Dry Bones. How would that have come about? How would that, really, when you think about it, if Israel had stayed in the desert, they would have all died there together, and there would have been a valley of dry bones. If the kingdom of heaven had not gone into the promised land, it would not have been the kingdom of heaven. It would have been the kingdom of dust.
Yeah, well, God would have withdrawn his protection from it. But anyway, wow. So then after the exile, God says, I'll give you another opportunity. Put you back in the land, but this time you need to do what your fathers didn't do. So he did not change the requirements to stay in the land. He didn't change them. There was only one thing he did change.
The location of the covenant.
Nope. Well, yeah, but it had to do with the judgment. He said that now instead of the children suffering for the sins of their fathers, each one will suffer for his own sin. So in the judgment, that individual who sinned would pay for the sin they did and not their children to the second and third and fourth generation.
And that is why the location of the covenant changed from being on tablets of stone to being in, needing to be in the heart and in the mind and in the innermost parts of that
in
individual person.
Consciousness awareness. Now, if you turn to Jeremiah 31, I appreciate the way that it is translated here in the Jerusalem Bible, 31:33. No, this is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel when those days arrive. It is Yahweh who speaks. Deep within them I will plant my law, writing it on their hearts. Then I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Plant. What is planted? What do we plant?
We want to grow.
What do we plant? Seeds.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
We plant seeds.
Right.
And seeds do what?
Grow, mature.
What's the first?
Yeah.
What is the first thing a seed does?
Sends out a root.
Sprouts
a root.
Germinates,
sprouts a root.
Yep.
Then it sprouts the plant.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? God says that the law will be like a seed that will germinate, sprout and grow, have a root. It will be in the heart, living, not dead,
mm-hmm.
living. Now he says, this is what he is going to do. But he's not going to do it arbitrarily. The people need to. He's already given them the seeds. He's given them the covenant, the Ten Commandments.
Mm-hmm.
They need to take that in. They need to let it start to grow in them. But they didn't.
Psalm 48 is a good parallel text.
Okay.
I delight to do your will, O my God. Your law is within my heart.
So,
okay.
So the heart, remember, is the intellect. The intellect is where the confluence of information goes. So it is the repository of knowledge.
In this case, I think heart is a combination of intellect and desire both. It can reflect both types of things.
Well, where do you get desire?
Appreciation of what's in your intellect.
If you don't have it in your intellect, how can you desire it? So you get all this information in your intellect. What happens to it? Well, the all this information comes in. So the woman received information from the serpent. You know, God knows that if you eat from that tree, you'll become like the gods, knowing good and evil. That goes into her intellect.
And she thinks
it's
about
processed,
it. Right.
And then what does she do?
Acts on it.
Makes a determination on it.
Right.
So God had said, don't ever eat from that tree. Where had that information gone?
Yeah.
Into her intellect, right?
Right.
So the serpent's information comes into the intellect, and it conflicts with the information that God gave.
That's called cognitive dissonance.
What does she do with the information that God, Elohim, gave her?
Throws it out.
Out.
Mm-hmm.
Replaces it with the lie. This is exactly what is going on today. The serpent is taking information. You go, oh, I like the way that sounds.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to be that way.
Yeah.
And so what do you do with what God has said? Out.
Yeah.
It goes out. Mm-hmm. And so your intellect is filling with lies
mm-hmm.
because it sounds so good.
Mm-hmm.
The information that the Son of God brought, the truth, is here. When it goes into our intellect, it conflicts with what we already know, what we've already been taught. We must decide whether we keep the truth or whether we keep the lie. But we have to get rid of the one or the other.
Wow, that was a great study. Thank you all. Thank you all for listening. And also, we encourage you to go to our blogtalkradio.com/SOT website and download this or any other of our 900 or so programs. We encourage you to join us next Friday for another edition of The Bible on Trial. This is at 10 o'clock. And a week from today for another edition of The Revelation of Jesus with Rick Sterling. Please make use of our website at spiritoftruthministry.net. On behalf of Spirit of Truth Ministry, this is Dennis saying, happy Sabbath, and we'll see you all next week.